Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. Today's case takes us back to Egypt, which I'm very excited about. I've loved Egyptian history since I was a child, and I still dream of getting to visit there one day. But specifically, we're going to be talking about colonial Egypt and the royal Egyptian family. The main victim in today's case is Fatia, an Egyptian princess who gave up everything she had for love. But to understand how all this happened, we need to know a bit more about her family first. So, beginning with Fuad I, who was Fatia's father. Fuad was born in the Giza Palace at Cairo. Fuad spent his childhood in Naples, Italy, where he was educated in a military academy in Turin. Prior to his becoming Sultan, he played a key part in establishing the Egyptian University, and he also served as the president of the Egyptian Geographic Society for 3 years. Fuad married his first wife, Princess Shaviakar Kunum Effendi, on the 30th of May in 1895. They had two children together, a son named Ismail Fuad, who died in infancy, and a daughter named Fawkia. But they were a very unhappily married couple, apparently. Fuad gambled away most of Shaviakar's fortune, which resulted in a massive argument between Fuad and Shaviakar's brother. And this argument got so heated between the two of them that Shaviakar's brother actually shot Fuad in the throat. Now, luckily he survived, but he had a scar on his throat for the rest of his life. And after only 3 years of marriage, he and Shaviakar were divorced. Now, Fuad ascended the throne of the Sultanate of Egypt when he was 49 years old after the death of his brother Hussein Kemal in 1917. But his rule was not a popular one. Many Egyptians were frustrated with him because of his refusal to support any reforms and his acceptance of the British protectorate over Egypt. The British government took an enormous amount from the Egyptian treasury to support the war effort for World War I. Apparently they took around £3.5 million sterling, which by my estimate is worth about £12 billion sterling today. And despite Britain's promise to shoulder the burden of the war effort, many Egyptians were dissatisfied when the creation of the Egyptian Labour Corps drew exclusively from the population of native Egyptians to create cheap labour for the British war machine. And there was a lot of like racism, and the people overseeing this Labour Corps treated the Egyptians horribly. In all, about 1.5 million Egyptians were forcibly conscripted into the Labour Corps. And during the war itself, the British stationed thousands of imperial troops in Egypt, taking over buildings, taking supplies and animals. Also, during this time, religious and economic conditions of many Egyptians was really, really deteriorating. Living costs were raised by the conflict caused by World War I, and heroin and cocaine were becoming a really big problem. The British and Western elite often completely disregarded all the religious needs of the Egyptian Muslims. Now, with all of this unrest, it was no wonder that a delegation of Egyptian nationalist activists made a request to the High Commissioner Reginald Wingate to end the British protectorate in Egypt and Sudan once the First World War armistice was declared. These delegates hoped to gain some Egyptian representation at the upcoming peace conference in Paris, and they hoped to push for full Egyptian independence. Just like Ireland pushed against British colonial rule back in 1916, now the Egyptians were trying to do the same thing. They wanted their own freedom and their own autonomy. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, the masses were pushing for full independence at the grassroots level. The Waft Party, which was a nationalist liberal political party, they were hugely influential in Egypt throughout the 1930s. They supported moving Egypt from a dynastic rule to a constitutional monarchy where power would be held by a nationally elected parliament. Waftist representatives would travel to towns and villages all over Egypt, collecting signatures from people petitioning for the complete independence of the country. But since the beginning of World War I, Britain still maintained martial law in Egypt, and so that meant they had enough power to push back against any uprisings and to squash any civil disobedience they wanted to. But because of the growing popularity of the WAFD party, the British arrested and exiled three of the movement's leaders to Malta in March 1919, which led to widespread disturbances. Around 800 people were killed, villages were burned down, land and property was plundered, and even railways were destroyed by the mobs of angry Egyptians. Now, after several more weeks, the people were in full-blown revolution. There were demonstrations and strikes across Egypt by students, civil servants, merchants, peasants, workers, and religious leaders. Normal life in Egypt had come to a complete halt, and most unusually for this movement, it had both male and female participants, and it also included Muslim and Christian Egyptians. During all this uprising, there was also attacks on British military installations, their facilities, and their personnel. And as a result, just like they did in Ireland, the British sent an armed force called the Egyptian Expeditionary Force to repress the entire region and restore control over the, quote, rabble. By July 25th, 1919, almost 1,000 Egyptians were dead and another 1,600 were wounded. The British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, sent a commission of inquiry called the Milner Commission to Egypt in December of 1919 to determine the root causes of all of this disorder and then to make recommendations on how to fix the situation. The commission report was published in February of 1921, and it recommended that the protectorate status of Egypt was not satisfactory and should be abandoned. This report, along with the revolts themselves, forced the government in London to declare unilateral Egyptian independence on the 28th of February in 1922. But despite being independent on paper, the British still had a lot of power and control in Egypt, and they also maintained a physical presence there. But regardless, many Egyptian people celebrated the significant steps that they had made towards self-determination. After this, Fuad declared his own declaration of Egyptian independence, and he decided to establish himself as the King of Egypt rather than his former title of Sultan. But nobody really cared about his declaration, since he had pretty much waited for British permission to do so, and people didn't really have much trust in him as a monarch. Now, it was probably out of necessity for a male heir and some good personal publicity that Fuad made the decision to get married for a second time as soon as possible. He decided to marry his second wife, Nazli Sabri, on the 24th of May in 1919, only 2 weeks after he first proposed to her. Now, just like she was his second wife, he was actually her second husband. They also had a significant age gap. Fuad was 25 years older than Nazli when he first saw her at an opera performance. Nazli was very well educated. She was a beautiful woman with dark hair and big dark eyes. And Fuad seemed to be more interested in watching her than watching the opera that night. Her father was Abdur Rahim Sabri Pasha, and he was the Minister for Agriculture and the Governor of Cairo, and her family had aristocratic ties in Turkey and in France. Nazli was born Alexandria Nazli Abdelrahim Sabri in 1894. She grew up and she went to school for a time in Cairo before she and her sister were sent to a boarding school in Paris for 2 years to finish their educations. When she finally returned to Egypt, she was old enough to get married, and she was pressured by her father to marry her cousin, Khalil Sabri, but that marriage ended only after 11 months. She was also engaged to another man briefly after this, before she met Fuad the First, who would go on to become her second husband. Now, as soon as they were married, Nazli was under immense pressure from her husband and, you know, his whole circle, to give birth to a son, and she literally wasn't allowed to live in the same palace as her husband until she gave him an heir. And with all of this, any hopes she had of a happier second marriage were soon vanquished. It was obvious to her that Fuad married her out of convenience, not out of love. But thankfully for Nazli, she did give birth to a son soon after the wedding. Prince Farouk was born on the 11th of February in 1920, and despite their marriage being rather unorthodox, Nazli and Fouad would go on to have four more daughters together, Fawzia, Faiza, Faika, and Fatia, who is actually the main victim in today's case. But despite producing an heir and four other healthy children, the marriage was not a happy one. King Fouad kept tight control over his precious only son, only allowing him to visit his mother Nazli once a day for an hour. It didn't help that Nazli was very independent and she was very emancipated for an Egyptian woman of her time. She was very well educated, as I said, and she liked Western literature and she had some strong ideas about women's place in society. She found her life as King Fuad's queen very restricted. She was only permitted to be in the palace and to attend ladies-only cultural events like opera performances or flower shows, and this was all just completely stifling to her. The royal couple would fight a lot, they would argue with each other continuously, and Fouad wasn't afraid to hit his wife. But I read that at one point Nazli slapped the king in the face, and he had her confined to her room for weeks after this. Now, after the birth of her fourth daughter, Fatia, on the 17th of December in 1930, Nazli's life was so secluded and controlled by Fouad that she felt like she only had one way to escape from him. She tried to take her own life by overdosing on aspirin pills, but a maid discovered her and she was saved by doctors. Not that she thanked them for it. By April 1936, King Fouad's health was in a very bad state. He had been suffering with an illness and a fever for 4 days. Apparently, he had some kind of gangrenous infection in his throat. The fever he had been battling had subsided, and it was showing some improvement, but he had also been given stimulants, which could have been the reason for this temporary improvement, and he wasn't actually doing much better, it just seemed like he was. So it came as a bit of a shock when he suddenly died of a heart attack on the 28th of April, aged 68. His wife Nazli placed a long-distance call to Prince Farouk, who was studying in Britain at the Royal Military Academy at the time, and sobbed to him, quote, "My son, you are king." Now, Princess Fatia was only 5 years old, and now her father was dead, and her 16-year-old brother, Farouk, was king. She and her sisters had all been given names that began with F, in honour of Fouad's beloved mother named Ferial. Now, despite being brought up under the care of an English nanny, Fatia was very close to her mother, and especially her sister Faika. The girls studied languages, music, and etiquette, and despite the siblings being relatively close, it was impossible to avoid the fact that the word of Farouk, their brother, was now law, and they all had to live by his decisions. Even though Farouk wanted to show a more modern image of the monarchy, by not forcing the royal women to live in seclusion, he still dictated if, who, and when his sisters and mother could marry. Nazli was now titled Queen Mother, and now she was a widow, she thought she could finally have some freedom in her life. But Fouad's selfish tendencies and controlling nature seemed to have passed on to his son. Farouk was a hoarder. He had to have the best of everything. Thousands of suits, cars, jewels, watches, and women. He had a museum-worthy collection of rare stamps, coins, and an incredibly large collection of pornography. He didn't care much about people around him. He would throw bread rolls and vegetables at people nearby in restaurants because he knew he could always get away with it. His sports cars would always be the colour red, so the police would know not to ever pull him over if he was speeding. He also had a bad habit of lying a lot, and he didn't have many friends. He was a constant womanizer, and he would often buy a woman's affection, or sometimes buy her family's permission to sleep with her. When Farouk found out his mother was in a secret relationship with the king's advisor named Ahmed Hassanian, things only became worse between the mother and son. Ahmed was a well-cultured man. He had studied law at Oxford University. He excelled at fencing, and he even represented Egypt at the Olympics 2 times. He was a reserved man with an elegant personality and a confident attitude, and he was a true gentleman. When he became Queen Nazli's Chamberlain in 1936, it was the same year that her husband died, and their relationship kind of grew from that point on. Farouk was horrified and disgusted that his mother would ever dream of wanting to remarry after his father's death. But mind you, his mother was only 41 years old. She was very beautiful, and you can imagine after having two pretty miserable marriages, she was desperate to finally have a relationship that she chose with a man who made her happy. But Farouk refused to let his mother remarry. And sadly, on Tuesday the 19th of February, 1946, Ahmad Hassanian was killed in a car accident. So Nazli never got the chance to marry the man that she loved for 9 years. And the relationship between Nazli and her son was now permanently damaged. 2 years passed after his father's death, and Farouk helped to arrange the marriage of his sister Fawzia to Reza Khan, who would go on to become the Shah of Iran, after she had only met this man one time. The marriage was a complete failure. Fawzia was completely miserable in Iran. She missed her home and her family in Egypt, and her in-laws greatly disliked her and feuded with her, and despite being one of the most shockingly beautiful women in the world, her husband was still unfaithful to her. When she returned to Egypt in 1946 to, quote, convalesce after an illness, Fawzia never returned to Iran, and she got a divorce from her husband in 1948. I mention this marriage because it will be important later on. Now, that same year, Nazli and her two youngest daughters, Faika and Fatia, went to the United States under the pretext that Nazli needed to undergo kidney surgery. On the 16th of September in 1948, they arrived by chartered plane, and Nazli entered into the Mayo Clinic Hospital for examination. Now, Farouk had permitted this journey. However, he didn't know that his mother, in secrecy, had collected all of her money before travelling with her two daughters and her public relations officer from the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, who was a man named Riyad Ghali. But after her successful recovery, Fatia and Nazli decided to settle in the US, enjoying the freedom they had from Farouk's control and the suffocation of royal life. Now, Nazli and her daughter were living very comfortably in a two-bedroom suite in San Francisco's luxurious Fairmont Hotel. The cost of their lodgings in today's money was over $1,200 a day. However, it was shortly after this that Princess Fatia, who was 19 years old, fell in love with her mother's secretary, Riyad Ghali, who was a 31-year-old man and a commoner. Ghali was living in a single-bedroom suite on the floor below Nazli and Fatia in the same hotel. Now, when Farouk found out about this relationship, he was livid. Not only was Riyad a commoner, but he wasn't even a Muslim. He was actually a Coptic Christian. Farouk was furious, but not just at Fatia, but with their mother too, because she was supporting Fatia's decision to marry Riyad Ghali. Now, for her part, Nazli had been pushed into two unhappy marriages herself, as had her eldest daughter, and she knew firsthand how miserably these relationships turned out. She wasn't about to let her youngest daughter's happiness be destroyed too. She wanted Fatia to have the happy marriage that she had always dreamed for herself. Why should she be forced into another dynastic marriage and be miserable? Meanwhile, Farouk flat out refused to allow his youngest sister to marry the man she loved. He thought Riyad was nothing more than an opportunistic sleazeball who was preying on his teenage sister, and so the rift between him and his mother and sister now was growing by the day. Fatia married Riyad despite her brother's absolute disapproval in a civil ceremony in San Francisco on April 25th in 1950, keeping the details of the ceremony a secret in case King Farouk's agents might try to stall the wedding in some way. Fatia wore a white imported French gown because her mother thought she looked very lovely in white. After the wedding, Farouk ordered his mother, Queen Nazli, and his sister, Princess Fatia, to return to Egypt within 60 days, but the women chose to defy his order. In fact, Farouk's ultimatum was so lightly regarded that Fatih and Riyad chose to completely ignore it, and instead they went on vacation to Lake Tahoe together. Fatih had no fear of infuriating the king anymore, in fact saying, quote, "He can punish us no further." But Fatih was very, very wrong about that. Farouk was livid. He saw this marriage as an embarrassment and a betrayal. He felt completely undermined by his mother, and so he made a royal decree that stripped his mother and his sister of all their rights, titles, and confiscated all of their lands and estates. The $5,000 a month allowance that Nazli received was now gone, as was the $2,500 that Fatih received. And that's not all, he also banned them from ever returning to Egypt, exiling them from their own home country forever. Now, Fatih had lost pretty much everything for the sake of her relationship with Riyad. However, Nazli was confident that her son would change his mind, saying, quote, "My son will be sorry. I know he always repents hasty actions. We will stay here until then." In an interview with the Miami Sunday News on the 30th July in 1950, Nazli said simply, quote, "I will leave San Francisco when I am ready to leave. Nobody ever influences me or has in my life. Once I think I have to do something, I do it." But that wasn't going to happen. Farouk was entirely set against them, and Egypt's royal council decided to declare Fatih and Riyad's marriage void. But Farouk was also dealing with some pretty hefty problems of his own. Things were not going well for him in Egypt. There was a massive wealth gap, and despite being the wealthiest country in the Middle East after World War II, many people in the country didn't even have clean water to drink, and they were also battling with very easily preventable diseases. Plus, even though the country was not at all ready for a war, Farouk went against the advice he had been given and went into a war against Israel, where Egypt was repeatedly defeated. And those were just some of the problems that the country was facing. I'm glazing over a lot. It didn't help Farouk's public image when he divorced his first wife, Queen Farida, who was very popular, and instead he chose to spend his time at luxury nightclubs like the Auberge des Pyramides with his mistresses and girlfriends. Eventually, to boost his own popularity, Farouk decided to marry an Egyptian commoner. He chose an 18-year-old teenage girl named Nariman Sadiq, who was actually already engaged to another young man. But Farouk didn't care, and instead he made her father a governor and broke off her engagement and sent her off to Rome to be trained to become a cultured lady fit to be his queen. I thought it was interesting that it's okay for Farouk to marry a commoner if he wants to, but it's not okay for his sister to marry a commoner. Anyway, Farouk also stipulated that before the wedding day, his teen bride must weigh under 110 pounds. Meanwhile, he weighed over 300 pounds himself. Just in case you can hear any noise, there's some hail outside on my window, so sorry about that if it's noisy in the background. In 1950, Farouk's personal fortune was around $140 million, which made him one of the world's wealthiest men. In today's money, that's at about $1.7 billion, just for context. He lived a shockingly lavish lifestyle. For his second bachelor party, he travelled to France at the casino in Deauville via his yacht. He and his 30 bodyguards, advisors, doctors, his whole entourage, travelled across France in a motorcade of Cadillacs, with the bodyguards on motorbikes and a helicopter flying overhead with the orders to land at any given time, just in case Farouk wanted to fly instead of being driven. His entourage occupied 25 rooms in the hotels that they stayed at, and Farouk would eat huge, lavish feasts and spend his nights gambling until 5 a.m. Then he travelled on to Biarritz and Cannes and San Remo in Italy, spending an absolute fortune along the way, as well as buying Roman antiques for his personal collection. His bachelor party went on for 2 whole months. And because of this, the people of Egypt were not very happy. They were on the verge of revolt because the country was in a state of financial, moral, and political bankruptcy. Now, trying to make the people happy, he married his teenage fiancée, Nariman Sadiq, in his usual lavish style on the 6th of May in 1951. But whatever little goodwill this generated was quickly dashed when the newlyweds spent 3 months on honeymoon in Europe, spending gargantuan amounts of money and enjoying huge feasts of food during the holy month of Ramadan, which is a huge no-no. In the end, after mass revolts, Farouk was widely condemned for his corruption, ineffectual governance, and the failed war with Israel. And so it came as a, you know, not much of a surprise in 1951 when a coup was being planned against him. Even after the birth of his son and heir, Crown Prince Fuad II, on the 16th of January in 1952, even this couldn't turn the tides in his favour. General Muhammad Naguib and Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser staged a military coup launching the Egyptian Revolution of 1952. 3 days later, Farouk was presented with an ultimatum to abdicate and leave Egypt by 6 p.m. the next day, or else the free officers would storm the palace and execute him. Farouk signed the instrument of abdication, and he boarded his yacht to leave Egypt for the last time, leaving behind many of his treasured possessions. Farouk set sail for Monaco and Italy, and for the first time now, Egypt was declared a republic. The government quickly began auctioning off all of Farouk's collections and treasures, all the stuff he hoarded, including one of the world's largest collections of pornography, as well as all of his diamonds, his rare stamps, his Fabergé eggs, furniture, medieval suits of armour, 10,000 silk ties, 50 diamond studded walking sticks, and his autographed portrait of Adolf Hitler. But Farouk didn't let any of this curb his lifestyle. He rented a massive estate outside of Rome called Villa Dusmet, and he spent his time womanizing in Roman nightclubs, as well as sending all of his children to be educated at the Institut Le Rosay in Switzerland, which was one of the most expensive private schools in the world. His second wife, Queen Nariman, had spent a few miserable years with Farouk, and eventually she had enough of his unfaithfulness. She left him on the 13th of March in 1953 to return to her home in Egypt to file for divorce from him. Now, back in the United States, while Nazli and Fatia no longer had their titles, Nazli still had a fabulous jewellery collection, and so they had quite a bit of money. Enough, in fact, for Nazli to buy a 28-bedroom mansion in Beverly Hills in 1955, where she, Fatia, Riyad, and the couple's future children would all live together. She also bought another house in Hawaii, and the three of them enjoyed partying and socializing and living the high life with other millionaires and famous celebrities in Beverly Hills. They attended grand openings, black tie dinners, and they frequented fashionable private clubs like the Cave des Rois, founded by Conrad Hilton, Paul Newman, Desi Arnaz, and Tony Curtis. Over the course of their marriage, Fatia and Riyad would have three children together. Rafiq was born on the 29th of November in 1952, Riyad was born on May 20th, 1954, and their daughter Rania was born on April 21st, 1956. During this time in the United States, both Fatia and Nazli decided to change their religion and become Roman Catholics. Fatia and Riyad's children were attending school, and life seemed to be pretty good. But Nazli made one massive mistake. She gave Riyad, her beloved son-in-law, her public power of attorney, and the right to run her businesses and manage her finances. Riyad gambled and poorly invested Nazli and Fatia's entire fortune in Mexican oil interests and properties that only made half of their estimated returns. Fatia was so devastated by what her husband had done that she separated from him in 1965 and moved into her mother's home in Hawaii. After the separation, another terrible revelation was discovered. Not only had Riyad lost the family's money, they discovered that he had also borrowed heavily and owed $100,000 a year in interest alone on the debts he accrued. I found an interesting document from the State Board of Equalization of the state of California where Riyadh was actually protesting against an additional income tax assessment for the year of 1957. For this appeal, he was trying to explain some of the surrounding circumstances in his life before he came to California. Riyadh's appeal alleged that after he married Fatia in secret, his passport was cancelled and he received threats from certain Egyptians warning him against the marriage. And, quote, in addition to passport cancellation, the United States had been asked to return appellant, his wife and her mother to Egypt. However, there was no actual deportation, end quote. And after this, Riyadh Ghali was regarded by the Immigration and Naturalization Service as having no lawful permanent status in the U.S. He was not allowed to leave the country or the state or to be employed or to engage in business prior to 1966 when his status changed to a lawful permanent resident of the United States. Riyadh also claimed that the Egyptian government seized property belonging to him, valued at $600,000, and a bank account with $100,000 in it, which meant that he could no longer receive bank statements or write checks from this account. I also learned from this document that it was Riyadh's intention to return to Egypt eventually once a more favourable regime was in government. Because he wanted to avoid an increase in his taxes, I think. It definitely seemed to imply that Riyadh was, you know, just swept up in the situation of his wife and his mother-in-law, and he didn't realise that when he would come to the United States that he would basically be forfeiting his passport and that he wouldn't be able to return to Egypt. And, you know, he made it seem like he was very much a victim in the situation of Queen Nazli and Princess Fatia and King Farouk. You know, he wanted to be the victim of this whole scenario. But news reached the family of King Farouk's sudden death on the 18th of March in 1965. He had collapsed at the Ile de France restaurant in Rome after having a massive midnight dinner of oysters and lamb, but he died immediately after being rushed to hospital. Now, despite Farouk's request to be buried at the Al-Rafai Mosque in Cairo, this request was denied. And even though they had a very contentious relationship, his mother, Nazli, travelled to Rome to attend her son's funeral service. Eventually, the remains of King Farouk were moved to the Al-Rafai Mosque, where the rest of his descendants are buried. After this, for Nazli and Fatia, things slowly but surely grew worse and worse. By 1972, Riyadh had stopped paying child support payments to Fatia for his three children, which forced Fatia to begin doing domestic work as a cleaning lady to make money to support her family and mother. Fatia would clean office buildings at night because, quote, it was the only thing I could do at the time, having no college background, end quote. Which I thought was just really sad. Like, not the fact that she was working as a cleaner, because it's a job like any other, but the fact that she grew up completely unprepared for life without having a massive fortune. She just wasn't prepared for anything else, you know? So, I don't know, like, it's weird to feel sorry for, you know, a princess. But you do feel sorry for her because she was never prepared to be anything other than a princess. So, Fatia and Nazli both filed for bankruptcy in 1973, listing all of their assets, including their jewellery, the mansions in Hawaii and Beverly Hills, their five cars, and an Arabian stallion valued at $5,000. Despite being happy living in Beverly Hills for a time, by the 28th of October 1975, former Queen Mother of Egypt, Nazli Fouad, was selling off about $1 million worth of her crown jewels. The collection of jewels, which was set to be auctioned off on the 20th of November at Sotheby's, included a Van Cleef & Arpels tiara containing 720 diamonds, weighing 274 carats, as well as a matching necklace formed by 600 round diamond and baguette diamonds arranged into a sunburst motif. The two pieces sold at auction for a combined total of $267,500. On the 21st of September, 1976, Fatia sat fighting back tears and watched the remnants of her and her mother's royal jewels be hauled into a bankruptcy court. There she spoke to a journalist and said, quote, "This is a difficult time." As she looked at the tables in the courtroom, there were two earrings, two necklaces, a ring, a pin, and a bracelet, all precious items which belonged to her 81-year-old mother. Apparently, the jewellery was so stunning that people in this ordinary, dreary courtroom were just standing there staring at the collection as it sparkled on the table. The judge was trying to auction all the pieces off to cover the $310,000 in debts. Now, Fatia described the jewellery to the journalist, saying, quote, "Those are pigeon blood rubies. My father chose them one by one for my mother. They are beautiful pieces, worth much more than that." Fatia's attorney hoped that the jewellery would bring the family about $500,000. A necklace with emeralds the size of small eggs, set in platinum, got a bid of $50,000. The whole collection itself got a few more bids, but unfortunately the highest bid was only $180,000 from a Los Angeles auctioneer named Sid Bush. Judge James Moriarty said that this bid was too low, and he claimed that the jewellery would have to be sold off privately to purchasers who might pay more in the hopes of paying off Fatia and Nazli's debts. Fatia and Nazli were now living together in a West Los Angeles apartment. The Beverly Hills mansion, the Hawaii mansion, that was sold long ago. Thankfully, in a small act of mercy, an anonymous family friend had been paying their bill, their rent bill, which helped take some of the pressure off of Fatia, but their larger debts still remained. Despite all this hardship, Fatia actually had hopes of returning to Egypt in January of 1977, and she was planning on setting up her own business. In a major breakthrough, the year before, in 1976, the current president of Egypt, Anwar el-Sadat, had sent a proposal to Nazli and Fatia that new passports would be provided for them, which would finally give them the right to return home. Fatia was considering running an import business, or maybe something like a travel agency or a public relations firm. And that just shows to me that she was a very resilient person. Fatia had lost everything, literally everything, and she was completely unprepared to live life as a common person. She was betrayed by the man that she went against her entire nation to marry, and she still did everything she could to keep her family afloat. But sadly, Fatia would never make it back home to Egypt, and she would never get the opportunity to start her own business. Because on the 10th of December, 1976, the day that she was supposed to leave to go to Egypt, she stopped by her ex-husband's house to return some of his mother's belongings to him. Now, even though Fatia and Riyadh had been divorced for several years now, they were still in some contact with each other from time to time, I'm guessing probably to do with their kids. Fatia found Riyadh to be very drunk inside his $200 a month apartment in West Los Angeles. We don't know if an argument broke out between them, but what we do know is when Fatia tried to leave the apartment, Riyadh could not accept that she was going back to Egypt and, in his mind, leaving him for good. So Riyadh Ghali shot Fatia 6 times in the head and face. And even more horrifically, the body of the former princess of Egypt was found by her 24-year-old son, Rafiq. Fatia was only 45 years old when the man who she gave up her entire inheritance and fortune for murdered her in cold blood and then turned the gun on himself. Despite trying to take his own life, Riyadh failed. And then he was transferred from UCLA Medical Center to the jail ward at County USC Medical Center for treatment for the bullet wounds to his head. After murdering his ex-wife, Riyadh Ghali, aged 57, was sent to the state prison after he was convicted of manslaughter before he eventually died in Santa Monica on the 13th of July, 1987. Nazli spent her final years living alone in her home, which was being paid for by some friends. After Fatia's violent death, she never returned to Egypt or saw her other children again, which is very sad. After the murder, she spent 2 years living alone, battling depression and loneliness, before finally passing away at the age of 83. She, her daughter Fatia, and her son-in-law, Riyad, are all buried side by side at the Holy Cross Cemetery in Ladera Heights, California. And that's where I'm going to leave this case, guys. As far as I can tell, Fatia's three children are still alive, and, you know, putting aside the riches and the titles, they're the ones who lost the most in all of this, their mother and their father. So I truly hope they're doing well in their lives, and I wish them all the best. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll talk to you all in the next episode. If you'd like to see any of the interesting images I found while researching this case, please follow along to my Instagram account at Dark Emerald Podcast. Feel free to like, share, send me a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the case. Bye.